If Murray has supported the show, I'd be less sick of podcasts.
Sending out good vibes. Good vibes. Good vibes. Good vibes. Good vibes.
Utter deep breaths of deep gratitude and prayers for guidance and protection. And put on a didgeridoo and shamanic drumming track. Shivers or vibrations and stuff like that.
Okay, guys, welcome back to the Grime America Show. Coming at you this week with Avital Levy, Building Resilient Families, and from Easter Island. So probably this won't be the full recap. We'll do a show for that, but we had to do an intro, so we figured we might as well do it while we're here.
Well, we're almost leaving, last day tomorrow, but a couple days to get home. It's pretty surreal here. I was driving around on a quad, like just the Pacific Ocean, such a small island, just the whole ocean there.
Yeah, well, today's Wednesday, so we leave tomorrow and we'll finally get home Saturday night.
Yeah.
Night in Santiago, night in the air, and a day in Dallas.
Yeah, it's been good.
Yeah, it wasn't as bad getting down here as I thought it was going to be. I definitely thought it would be more of a slog, but the way back could still be a slog.
Yeah, I got a 7-hour drive after we get home, so that'll be kind of weird. Yeah,
through the planes.
Yeah, three. How many planes? No, four planes. Four planes.
Four planes and a long drive.
A long drive. Yeah, that's okay. I mean, it was good.
It was. Yeah, more doable than you'd think. More doable than you'd think to get down here. But it's been a pretty good trip. Weather's been great. Sun shining. Yeah. Not too much rain. Seen a million Moais. A
million Moais and a whole bunch of platforms. Of course, you know, as usual, what happens on hot days. I didn't know we were going to be in the sun all day long, so a lot of us got a little bit burnt on the first day. I thought there'd be more shade, more time in the bus, but we were just hanging around outside for too long. So I've been fighting off a bit of a burn for the whole trip.
You got sunburned.
Yeah, it's just stupid me.
I got tanned. A bunch of people got sunburned pretty good. I mean, the beach was amazing. Tons of Moais.
The guide was amazing, Alejandro. We're going to have to do like a shout out with him. Actually, we'll probably have him for a full episode. He's got some really cool old pictures too. So
yeah, we'll have Alejandro on the show. Alejandro Padaraki, Easter Island Expeditions. That's who we went out there with. Had a great time. And some nice half days and stuff. So we got to enjoy the island a little bit. And have a time. Tonight will be our last dinner and we'll fly home tomorrow, and next week we'll dig into a full recap. Got some videos, got some pictures. Hopefully we can get some stuff on the YouTube channel.
I'm really looking forward to picking your brain about, because this is iconic, right? 13 years with the podcast and the Moai as our mascot, really. And now we're here, pretty surreal, and we had lots of time with the guide and lots of time to look around and think about stuff and a great group of people to chat with. So I'm looking forward to seeing what you think about that, because I'm flip-flopping back and forth on everything. After what I saw today, I was like changing my mind again, kind of. I'm like, well, it can't be.
Well, the Peruvian wall was pretty interesting for sure, and the basalt Moais. Where'd you go today?
To Moai Road. Kyle took us down a path off the track with the quads, and we were on the Moai Road where all the Moais came down from the quarry. So we went the back road, the Moai Road to the quarry, and they're just big, massive Moai sporadically, like just lying down on the road, fenced off, like you can't touch them. They still don't want you touching them. They're very serious about...
Don't touch the Moai.
They're very serious about keeping you off of sites. So it was pretty surreal to be on our own on the off-road path where all the big Moais were laying down, scattered around on their way down the mountain.
They don't care about drinking and driving or smoking weed or anything else. Just don't touch the fucking Moais.
Super chill. The Chileans are awesome. Super chill.
Well, yeah, Santiago wasn't chill.
The people were still pretty chill. Pretty they're chill. Hanging out in parks. They just seem to be doing their thing in the moment. They seem like a content people. I mean, I don't know, you know, how much that's... What?
I don't know about in Santiago. Seems less content than here.
Yeah, maybe.
And the... you definitely noticed a lot more of the poverty in Santiago than here.
Yeah.
Here it seems everyone's pretty chill.
Yeah.
Having a time, getting by.
Just reworking old cars, renting out old quads.
Living the island life.
It's like a mix between Mexico and Hawaii, basically.
Yeah. The experiment continues of greater Mexico. And we might do it again. So if that's something you guys are interested in, let us know. Shoot us an email. We can keep it on the list if we do decide to come back down. Of course, we got Serpent Mound coming up in 6 weeks. That'll be the next chance to hang out at contact@thecabin.com. And we do need you to support the show. GrabAmerica.ca/support. We keep working even on while we're working away. We still keep the episodes coming out. This one's a day late. Last week's came out on time. And next week we'll be back to the regularly scheduled programming. Of course, it wouldn't be right if we didn't do at least record a little bit while we were actually on Easter Island.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm looking forward to doing a wrap-up with it, maybe with some video and some pictures and stuff, and we can go over it all.
Absolutely. You guys can look forward to that. Thank you for listening. Do support the show, grabamerica.ca/support. Do you have a bio?
Well, I've got some website here, hifam.com, hifam.com, and her YouTube channel is at hifamlife. And you'll get everything from there. She's a mother of, I think, 5 or 6. And she's written this amazing book. She talks about harmony and family and marriage and reclaim play. So check out the show notes if you want those links, or just go to hifam.com.
There you have it, guys. Do support the show. GrabAmerica.ca/support. Most of all, enjoy the chat with Avital Levi.
All right, we've got an interesting episode here with Avital Levi. She's in Israel. She's been writing about and teaching about family life, the Parenting Junkie, HiFam, the YouTube channel. So we're looking forward to getting into a different topic for us in a way, but one of the most important ones in the world. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Yeah, this will be interesting. Darren, how did you come across Avital? Like, do you want to start a little bit about maybe what we want to get into here before we get into her background and why she started to teach about this?
Well, somebody emailed me.
Okay.
I don't know if it was a guest connection or what happened there, but I mostly just responded to an email. So I think it's an interesting fit. We've kind of, you know, we've had Glover on and all these guys over the years. We've sort of dabbled in and out of it. And I mean, you're in Israel, so it's interesting to see, because that side, I mean, Israel, the Middle East especially, seem to have still more of a grasp on family in a lot of ways than the West does. It seems to be taken a lot more seriously over there. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's totally fair to say. Yeah. Israel's actually the only kind of Western democracy that's growing in terms of its population, where people are well above replacement rate. And that's true even for the secular people in Israel. So it's a real outlier in that regard. And there's, I think, a lot, you know, for the UK and the US and Canada, et cetera, to be reverse engineering and learning from that, because it's a great kind of, you know, case study in family.
I didn't know that.
What do you think they got to learn? What are the major differences? Why is Israel the only place in the Western world, or at least when compared to the Western world, that's doing above replacement demographics? I think where I am is probably one of the highest in the Western world. I think it's the highest in North America. In Alberta, we have the youngest population. And even that is like just, you know, we're at like maybe 1.9 to 2.0. You know, we're somewhere in there.
Yep.
But still not above replacement. We're just sort of the last demographic in North America that's sort of barely hanging on.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a fascinating subject. I spend a lot of time thinking and reading about it, but I'm not an expert. I can just tell you what I see around me. You know, places like South Korea are at 0.7, you know, kids, which is, you know, well below replacement. And then Europe is around 1.8 on average, something along those lines. And then in Israel, it would be about, I think it's 2.7. 2.9 to 3. So that's well above replacement rate. And, you know, some of the things that increase birth rate in a place like Israel are not things that you want to replicate elsewhere, right? Now, that might be because we have a big ultra-Orthodox community, but it's also because when you're under existential threat and there's this, you know, very strong kind of heritage and drive, you know, after wars, a lot more babies are born. There are baby booms and we have lots of wars. You know, I'll just share that growing up, I have five siblings, and growing up, my mom explicitly said that she felt a real responsibility to replenish what we had lost in the Holocaust. So there was really a nationalistic kind of drive to kind of do your part. So those are things that I'm not sure that the West can or should replicate. But there are other things that I think really could be replicated and that are really, you know, ideal. And that's a very pronatalist culture. And those are things like children really being seen as a blessing, as a good thing, welcome everywhere you go. You know, I bring the example that if you're invited to a wedding and you just, whatever, your babysitter bailed, you could show up with your kids and it wouldn't be awkward in Israel. You know, I've been to wine festivals at like 11 p.m. with people just with babies strapped to their chest and that kind of thing. It's not at all unusual. You don't really need to bring your kid to work day. Kids are welcome in almost every space. So that's something that I think also infiltrates the mind of individuals, where we see children as something possible, as not a massive stretch. You know, I think I lived in America for 8 years and I grew up in London. And what I've noticed, the difference between these cultures is really the approach, not just to children, but to motherhood. You know, motherhood is seen as uncool, as something that's going to kind of lower your standing and prestige. You're going to be behind. You're going to, I kind of say that kids will ruin everything from your bank account to your pelvic floor. Like, it's just going to destroy all elements of your life. You know, years and years of feminism that has taught us that we should be climbing the corporate ladder rather than building a family in our, you know, 20s and 30s. A lot of medical kind of, I would call it misinformation about the ability to delay and the success rates of IVF and the success rates of freezing your eggs and that kind of thing. So a lot of messaging has worked against motherhood in Western democracies. And some of that comes to Israel as well, but there is some shielding against it, I think, because motherhood is actually seen as not just noble or, you know, admirable, but also entirely possible. Like, there's a real resilience that I think women have in their mindset here, where I can build a career, I can stay healthy, and I can be a mom, and I don't have to give up on that, on one for the other. I think that's a mindset that Western women could hear a lot more about, you know, a lot less about how lame and expensive motherhood is, but a lot more about how it's a really viable path to meaning in your life.
And that's the big one, right? Like, when you look at all the stats, the women who are having children are having the same amount of children.
That's like, right.
If you look at four children, five children, three children, two children, one children, all that math or all those stats sort of trend properly.
Yep.
Those aren't changing. It's not like people who used to have four kids are only having two kids, or I'm sure that's happening, but it's not the problem on mass. There's one outlier in all of those demographics, and that's zero children women. That's the one stat that's skewing the whole thing, because
yeah,
the other stats aren't changing. Five kids, four kids, three kids, two kids, one kids. Those are almost identical across the board. They're trending up with the populations, but childlessness seems to be the one that's really causing problems. If you could solve that one problem, you could fix it.
Well, yeah, that's a huge problem to solve.
Maybe not fix it, but you know what I mean? Like, and not, I don't mean fix everything, but that is the one problem against demographics right now.
Right. And I would make an even finer point, which is that I think if you are childless by choice and it's an informed choice, then, you know, God bless, Godspeed, everybody should do them. But the shame of it is the people who are childless, not by choice, and who end up child. And, you know, it's hard to decide what is a choice. Like if I said, you know, no to three marriage proposals because I was waiting for Mr. Right, and then eventually he never showed up and I had the wrong expectations of marriage.
Well, then, is that my choice? That,
you know, does then that, you gotta factor in
the guys like Graham that made the choice, thought it was the right choice, and then they got older, they were like, shit, man, maybe that wasn't the right choice. So it's like, even in the moment, what choice are you making? What, where are you getting the information to make the choice?
Oh yeah, let me speak to this personally, because I, in the 90s and the early 2000s, I mean, I was really, I was in a rebellious way. I was like, I don't need to spread my seed and my genes. Like I was like sort of, you know, holier than thou about not needing to do that. Right. Like there's too many people on the, I really thought there was too many people on the planet. It's like, I got sucked into the whole thing. And I thought that was I thought that was like, you know, cool and rebellious. Right. Yeah. And now I realize it's all just bullshit, most of it. And I'm like, oh man, like, I didn't have, it's not like I had the perfect relationship where I said no to all that, but it definitely affected my choices in trying to find that relationship. Like I was with, you know, older women that never could have really, you know, done that. I probably would have made different choices if I would have not been so brainwashed, you know. But I have also heard from close loved ones that from the feminist angle that I haven't really been able to reconcile. Like there's a fear, and I've seen women that fall into this category where they get with a man and a family and all that, and then the guy turns out to be shit, let's say, and then they're kind of stuck, right? Like I think the problem that is hard to reconcile with feminism is the way women get stuck not building a career, like working on the family, and then if shit goes south, they really don't have anything to fall back on. Right now they need another man kind of thing to take care of them. So I don't know if you address that at all, or if you have any thoughts on that, but it's something that I do have sympathy for from the sort of the women or the feminist angle. Like I know, you know, really close friends that have been through that, you know, where they're like, I didn't want to get stuck with a man and then not have anything in the end. So.
Yeah. I mean, I hear that fear, and you know, I have about five close couples around me who are going through pretty nasty divorces. So I see it up close and personal. And I coach people on marriage.
You sit around you. So is that as big? Is that as prevalent as in Israel as it is in the West? Then divorce and this sort of thing. Because in the West, it's, you know, we're 50-50. It's a coin toss.
Right.
And if you add in like unhappy married people, it's probably more like 3-1.
Right. I don't think our rates are quite as high. Not all the couples I'm mentioning actually live here. So a couple of them are in America. But yes, it does happen here. It happens everywhere. And, you know, Israel is a modern liberal democracy, if you can call it that, in whatever way. And so all of those ideas, you know, come here too. And I'm not anti-divorce. I think, you know, there are cases in which divorce is the right thing, especially when it's a last resort, you know, when you've tried other things and when staying is worse than leaving, and all of that can be true. I'm quite conservative when it comes to divorce, in the sense, especially when there are children involved, in the sense that I do think it should be a last resort. And I do think there should probably be a really good reason for it. And we should get really clear on what's on the other side of that. Like, is that truly better than staying? Because staying is imperfect always. No marriage is perfect. But then, you know, we have to make sure that it would be an improvement, not just for both of the couple, but for the children. And so putting that to one side, the risk involved in getting married for women and men, you know, if you delve into the manosphere, you'll see many men who are petrified of being trapped in marriages and trapped in child support for years and all of that kind of thing. So I know that both genders have become very suspicious of the institution of marriage of late. And I mean, that's fair. You know, marriage can go badly south and you can go on a series of decisions that lead you to be in a weak position in your life, right? Where you have neither the partner nor the career, and you do feel trapped or stuck or poor as a result, and that's nasty. My only counter to that really is that, you know, worthwhile things in life do involve risk. And I think that I personally see the potential, you know, Graham, as you know, it doesn't always work out, but the potential for it to work out, for you to have a lifelong partner, you know, in every area, financially, sexually, building your home together, a co-founder of a legacy, of a family, partnership, hopefully into old age. The upside of that is so tremendous that, yes, you can put some, you know, protective elements in place. I'm not against that, you know, certain agreements, keeping one foot in the world of working. I think that's great for women. Like, don't let go of everything. You know, have some level of independence, not least because even if you don't get divorced, your husband could get sick. You know, your husband could, God forbid, you know, die. I have a lot of widows around me, young widows with children. They need their careers. You know, these are real realities of life. I don't think it's ever great to put all your eggs in any basket. But I think the risk of, you know, him ending up being, you know, rubbish and leaving you and you hating that, that's a risk. And we should mitigate for that. And I really believe in teaching our children to look for the right partner. I believe in guiding them in what they should be looking for. You know, I'm curious, Graham, how much guidance you got on that in that regard. I feel like a whole generation got none, like zilch. Well,
that's what I was just going to say, is that I feel like the antidote to that whole thing is making it, again, culturally important to have family. Like, that is the like your purpose in a way. Like, your purpose is to build the best family you can. Like, that's the most important job in the world, is a parent, being a parent. Like, we have to get back to, like, that is the most important thing.
Well, amen. I agree. I really
do. It's like they found a way to hack that out of us somehow, right? Because we're fucking hardwired for it all the way, and we kept the sex drive and all that stuff, but they managed to, like, cheapen that to the extent that the two aren't connected anymore.
That's an amazing point. And I think that's why we don't always understand the downsides of technology, like the pill, right? Which have delinked sex and reproduction. So you really mess up an entire generation, and you couple that with the, you know, the panic around population growth that Graham was talking about in the 90s. And yeah, people opt out. I mean, to the extent that, I don't know, did you guys ever catch the Denmark campaign, Do It for Denmark? You know, this was absolutely fascinating. It was 10 years ago now, but Denmark as a government ran a campaign called Do It for Denmark. And their whole thing was trying to encourage couples to have kids. Oh, and their way of doing that was that they subsidized a romantic getaway to Paris. And they thought, okay, on little, you know, romantic trips, people will have more sex. If they have more sex, they'll have more kids, which, as we know, is not necessarily true. But it was just so fascinating because it didn't work at all. They poured millions into this. Because of being politically correct, they also sent elderly couples and gay couples, because, you know, so they're just like subsidizing these romantic getaways. And, you know, it's just a misunderstanding of what drives people to having children and of how it works.
What is that then? Because you'd think that money would have been better spent as, like, you get a housing subsidy for a year, or you get, you know, kids are expensive regardless of your healthcare system. They come with all this other stuff and missing work. Someone's going to miss work now. And all. So some of these countries have their, like, maternity things and now paternity things and stuff like that, where the state's sort of picking it up. But it seems like that money would be better spent on, like, that first year when it's a real hit and all that sort of stuff.
So what's fascinating, and linking back to what you said earlier, that the biggest issue is people not having children at all. In countries like Sweden, like Hungary, many countries offer full paternity and maternity leaves, even for a whole year at times. They offer free childcare, creches, you know, very, very lovely, small, you know, kind of babysitting environments, and money. So in Hungary, you don't pay income tax after your third child. You get a huge loan when you get married, I think, and it gets forgiven when you have kids. Like, you have all these financial incentives. And yes, it's true that children are expensive, but here too, Israel is an interesting case study. Israel has one of the highest cost of livings per capita in the world. It's a very expensive country. And people still have those three, four, five children. I mean, I have five children. Almost all my friends around me have five children. It's not special. And cost of living, and we have, I would say, modest government subsidies. It's not enough to pay for a child. Okay, so children are still expensive for Israelis. And yes, we have free healthcare, free, you know, paid for by taxes, obviously, and education. But as I said, cost of living is very expensive. It's
we have the worst version of that where we pay the taxes and don't get the healthcare. So nowadays they'll just kill you. Just like, really, hey, you're getting old, this is expensive. Why don't you do, you can get this in 2 years or what, we could kill you today.
And that's on offer, right?
Yeah, the government is now, it's now the fifth leading cause of death in Canada is medical assistance and dying from the government. And now we're having lawsuits where people like said that the person wasn't in capacity to do it and they did it anyway. And organ problems where I just had to revoke all my organ donor stuff because they're at the point now where they'll like tell your family to go fuck themselves because your organs are spoken for. We got a weird world over here in Canada.
I hear a lot of podcasts about Canada. I don't know what's going on.
Because we have the free healthcare, but good luck fucking accessing it.
Yeah. Wow.
How is that compared in Israel? Is yours pretty
state
of the art, right?
We have very high, you know, Israel could really do a lot more about, you know, I think I'm a capitalist and I would love to see more financial freedom and less red tape and less bureaucracy. So our taxes are exceptionally high. They're about 50%. But I think that, you know, well, it's complicated. I don't know how much you want to get into it, but there are certain segments of society that don't pay any taxes here. Two very large segments of society. And so the third of society that carries the whole country pays very high taxes. And yes, we have reasonably good education and I think pretty excellent healthcare, I would say. I think it's world class. And the waiting times aren't horrendous. Like I think you can get well treated. So you get some of your money's worth. But the vast majority of our government spending, I don't know about the majority, but a huge chunk just goes to defense. You know, so that's where we can't like build stunning parks and roads at the moment because we're just paying, you know, to expose miles in the sky. Yeah,
that's interesting about the cost of living because I was going to ask you about how much the economy plays a role in this in the West. So, I mean, maybe Israel, no, but you see all those memes about the 50s in America where you could have on one salary, you could have a house and a car and three kids and the mom could stay at home and look after the kids. And that really did seem to be like a change where they started to, the moms started to go to work more, you know, it almost felt like a shift to get women in the workplace.
Yeah. It was. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So here's the interesting thing. In the West, when you ask people why they don't have kids, they tend to cite economic reasons. They tend to say it's for financial reasons. But the data doesn't quite support that, at least not in a straightforward way, because if you look at the poorest areas and the poorest countries in the world, they're having the most kids.
Right.
And so it doesn't, you know, it's something more to do with a match between our expectation of parenting and of how much kids should cost and that kind of thing. Like a lot of parents in the West now assume that they shouldn't have a kid unless they have everything ready for that child, right? I need to already have the college fund built out. I need to have the home. The child must have their own bedroom and their own, you know, 20 Christmas toys. And I think there's a lot of heightened expectations around what kids need and what they would cost and what I need to give my kid much more than I had, that type of thing. And at least, you know, I don't buy into that personally. I think kids can grow up in a simple environment. They don't need all the bells and whistles. In fact, sometimes I think that makes things worse, makes them very materialistic and consumeristic and anxious and depressed. All of that doting and attention and physical, you know, material stuff is not good for children. So I think we just got it wrong. And the main reason I think that we're not having kids in the West is, again, it's a mindset around do we value family? Do we see family as the most meaningful project, as you put it, Graham, of our lives? And I think that has been lost to other things. You know, no, I've got to say, I'm really blessed in that I love my career. I love what I do for a living. But it pales in comparison to the meaning that I gained from raising my children. And I don't know the woman on earth, or the man, frankly, whose career, you know, supplies them with so much more lasting meaning than, you know, a bond of the type that parenting could. And so I think in a sense, we've just kind of misplaced the main focus of life, more like we work for our family rather than, you know, our family comes after work.
Well, how much does that have to do with just the dissolution of culture? Like, I mean, we can all sort of, I don't know about in Israel, but in Canada, I think most of us, I don't know about Graham, but we can just look back like 10, 20, 30 years and you can see that, well, maybe when our grandparents were around, there was way more big family get togethers. You were getting the family together more often. Whereas now I don't even talk to my cousins and shit for years on end. So I'd imagine that's got to be playing a role at some level. And then, like you guys touched on earlier, I'd be interested in your opinion on that, because you mentioned career and women working and how it's good to have that option and freedom and individuality. But how much is that affecting childbearing? Because I mean, I would argue that if you look back into ancient and culturally and stuff like that, I mean, my wife hates working. Most women seem to be, and I'm not going to, I'll generalize because I don't have a choice, but most women seem to be happier when they're at home taking care of kids. And it seems to be evidenced by the fact that the only reason they're not doing that is because they think they can put it off till later, which you can prove just by going on. I mean, I haven't been on one in years because I'm married, but if you look at when I was, after my first divorce, after my only divorce, when I was dipping back into the dating world, I mean, almost every woman in their 40s, early 40s, late 30s on those dating apps say they want kids.
Yeah.
And like maybe one in 20 or one in 30 of them are going to get those kids they want, right? Mm. There's almost no chance. If you're 40 and you're just on Tinder saying you want kids, I mean, unless you're like, waltzing in and getting knocked up in the first couple of weeks here, if you're looking to actually build some stuff and this and that, then by the time you're ready, you're like right at the upper echelon.
Yeah.
Right at the upper, where it's probably not going to be possible. And I can't help but blame career on that. I mean, what else is to blame on the delay?
Well, I think career is certainly a big part of it. You know, the feminist idea that you are your job or you are your career, and that's the main focus, you know, but there are other things. You can see an elongated childhood for both men and women in the West at the moment, right? A delay of taking accountability, you know, living in our parents' basements and kind of not really moving on into the world and taking responsibility. And I think there's a lot of other elements that could go into this. For example, if you look at kind of what Instagram has done to women, right, where women have become branded, they see themselves as kind of constantly through the lens of a filter or through the lens of social media or through the lens of their brand and how they appear. You know, motherhood doesn't fit in all that well with that, right? Motherhood can really take you down several notches in terms of, as I said, cool factor, as it were. And then, you know, I think the main thing that you're pointing to is actually just the timing of it. I think it's, you know, it works for women to have children in their 20s and then build their career in their 30s.
Yeah,
and it's already going out of school. There's no reason not to do that. But as I said, there's this readiness kind of myth in the West. I'm not ready to date. I'm not ready to get married. I'm not ready to have a child. And I think maybe our grandparents just did not have that myth that everything has to be lined up, that I have to check all the boxes, that I need to be ready. It's kind of like jump and the net will appear. Start and you'll gain your sea legs as you go along and you'll figure it out. That is one thing I can say about in Israel is that women have children earlier. It's typically in their mid-20s versus in the States where it would be in their early 30s or even late 30s. And there's no...
Because it is pretty early to do, easy to do it later, right? Like if you have kids when you're 20, by the time you're into your mid-30s, you're good to go. You got 30 years left.
Well, exactly. And you also have a lot of time management skills and you're not pressured and distracted by the dating world. And, you know, I don't know, I can speak as someone who, my youngest is 5 now, you know, I can work out every day. I can spend time working on my business. I can write a book. These are things I can do, even though I have 5 kids, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't deplete from that for me. And I think a lot of women at that point in their life, when all their kids are in school or as the kids grow older, are looking for something in addition. Even if it's not financially driven, it's a time where they want to self-actualize, when they want to work, when they want to be out in the world, where they don't just want to be mom. And I think that's fair, whether it's for financial reasons or not. I also think women, like men, have been burnt by this kind of traditional division of labor, and they are afraid of being financially dependent on a man. And I get that. But I think that that could and should be overcome by kind of sanctifying and being more careful about marriage, like making marriage a more stable commitment, a more full partnership, you know, something that's more reliable for both of them. So there is quite a lot broken here in terms of mindset for parenting, you know. And
you mentioned dating. How much does that have to do with it? Because, I mean, the other thing our grandparents didn't have to contend with was every man and woman on the internet, every man and woman in the country. For a large part, you didn't go far from where you were born for the most part. I mean, yeah. You can even see how much of this shit went down during the war, where these dudes got like shipped away from their hometown for the first time and ended up fucking other women. It was this sort of weird mess where up until then you didn't really get too far from your town. So your options were your town or your, you know, that's especially the cities have become more and more prevalent. But if we go back to ancient, chances are, you know, you're talking about 30, 40, 50 women in your sort of tribe, and you're probably got your eyes on a few of them from day one, and then it's down to one, and there's no real competition for that attention.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you said before that you don't speak to your cousins anymore as much and that kind of thing. Even just moving away from family in general is quite kind of a new phenomenon to the extent that we do it today, right? Where people just leave the country, leave the continent, and aren't necessarily close. By the way, that's another interesting thing about Israel, just to bring it back to that, is that grandparents are very involved here. And I think that's a huge factor in raising kids. It makes things a lot easier. You know, it's very common to see grandparents picking up from kindergarten and that kind of thing, and not necessarily just the parents. So there's really an expectation of intergenerational help and cross-family help. Another nice thing that is lost in the general losing of culture, as you mentioned, is like gathering, right? Ritual, whether you're religious or not, but it's much easier to hold on to it when you're in a religious environment, because you gather for whatever it is, Easter and, you know, Christmas, etc. And there's ritual around it. And there's an expectation that family will do these things together. You know, in Israel, there are so many holidays and rituals and expectations. There's rites of passage when you're 13 and 12, right? Bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah. There's initiations for the baby. And there's, you know, a real rhythm to the year where you're constantly kind of breaking bread with people. And we do it without any technology, without phones, right? We put our phones away. So you have many, many meals, in fact, every week at the Sabbath, where you're gathering around a table for a Thanksgiving style meal, right? With no phones in the vicinity at all. So you're really making eye to eye contact with people, having deep conversations. That's the time when I'm telling my kids what to look for when you're dating, you know, what questions to ask, what to figure out, you know, like, in my belief, the way that we as parents need to help our children to overcome this cultural, you know, kind of confusion is to help them see dating as a pathway to finding a lifelong partner to build their life with, right? Not just casual sex, not just for the moment, you know, not sticking around with someone for 8 years and then seeing where it will go, but really kind of interviewing people for a co-founder position in the business of your life, right? Where they're going to build with you, build something meaningful and lasting and strong. And so dating is for fun, you know, in that regard.
Do you guys shut down for those things? Like I often wonder if there's like this underlying thing where having society open 24/7 every day. Like I even noticed coming to the city from where I grew up, where at least on like Christmas, everything was closed for 3 or 4 days. If you wanted to get your alcohol for over the Christmas thing and stuff like that, you'd have to do all that on like the 23rd, because nothing was going to be open again till the 27th or 28th. And then you have the same sort of thing on Thanksgiving and Easter, where there's nothing open. All the fucking stores are closed. All the restaurants are closed. The grocery stores are closed. There's nothing to do. Whereas now Boxing Day sales. I can go watch a movie on Christmas Day. I can go out for dinner for Chinese food on Christmas Day. Now, I'm not saying that all the cultures should have to do the same thing, but that's got to be playing a role where we've got all these options to do everything, whereas our grandparents probably didn't have shit to do for that entire week of Christmas. There was literally nothing to do but sit at home.
Okay,
or go to hockey with your friends or all these sort of things. But as a society, we had sort of agreed that no, nothing, we're not doing anything. There's no other options. So you might, you know, and it's not like it forced it, but it just sort of has this natural thing where the same as you sort of mentioned with the Sabbath, if you shut off the TV and all the phones and all the shit, then naturally things are going to.
And that's gonna weekly, yearly. That's weekly, not yearly. So how powerful is that, that every week you do that? Like, that builds up.
It's amazing. I had some guests here from Salt Lake City a few weeks ago, and I was trying to explain to them what's going to happen on Friday afternoon in Jerusalem. And I was like, look, towards sunset, there won't be any buses. All the stores will close. Everyone will be kind of rushing home with bouquets of flowers and the getting stuff out the oven and getting ready and getting on their Sunday best and gathering. Phones will be away. All electronics will be away. We won't be cooking or cleaning or doing laundry or checking on work or doing any of that stuff. We'll light candles and then we'll sing some songs, prayer, whatever, however each person brings in their Sabbath. And then we'll gather around the table for an old-fashioned meal. And in that meal, it will be really encouraged to, you know, have debate, meaningful conversation, to bring up ideas, to discuss philosophy. And that's going to happen for 25 hours. So from sundown on Friday to sundown on Saturday, we won't get our phones out. Even we're going through a war or whatever, obviously the emergency workers and anyone who might be called up or that kind of thing is going to have their phones. But apart from that, you will not see no children will be using any devices for the entire weekend in an Orthodox home, in a Jewish home. And so that's a powerful technology right there for maintaining peoplehood, connection, family. Look, you know, I have to play a board game with my kids. I have to kick around a ball with them. We have to have families over for some entertainment and some connection and some community, because otherwise it's boring, right? And that's what it's all about. That's what it's for. And there is a sense that we're living for the weekend, like that we're building up towards that moment where we switch everything off and we go internal and we focus on relationships, on spirituality, on community, not on work. You know, you're actually discouraged from even discussing financial stuff. Like, oh, that's business. Leave that till after the Sabbath. We won't talk business now. I do think that's a powerful glue that keeps people together. And I'm not sure. I'm really trying to figure out how we can do that in a secular environment. That's what I do in my coaching. You know, I run a membership all about family culture. And family culture, look, I'm very lucky to be living in this kind of ancient society that does still do these things like disconnecting from technology and creating community. But I think that's possible in a secular environment, but it does take quite, you know, countercultural effort, tremendous effort to maintain and to preserve that. And I think beyond that,
I really think that closing stuff has a huge part of it. I mean, I really think that's a huge thing, because not only is there, I can't go to the movie, I can't go to the arcade, I can't go to the bar, I can't XYZ, I can't go shopping, I can't, none of those people have to work.
Oh, absolutely.
So the other problem that our 24/7, 365 society in the West is that someone's always working, you know, every Christmas, one of the family members, you know, that it's someone's always working. Like, these holidays literally have no meaning left anymore. I mean, we have family day here where we're supposed to be the family days one day a year, but everything's open. So right. You know, how many hundreds of thousands of people have to go to work that day?
Right. And it often becomes a lot about shopping, right? When I lived in the U.S.
That's what our culture has devolved to. It's like all those holidays have Thanksgiving. We got Black Friday after that. We got Boxing Day after Christmas. It's sort of degraded to that. And talking here, it almost seems like it's almost like convenience. Adding in the convenience to just do other things that are maybe more distracting or easier or less effort. It's just maybe laziness. I don't know.
I think that's so interesting. That's such a deep insight, because I think convenience, you pay a very high price for convenience in every regard. And I think convenience is often, or comfort is often the source of our ailments in the West. You know, kids in the West today are more miserable than anyone prior, and they are the most privileged generation ever. So it's really bizarre to see kids who have everything they could want for. They live in peace and prosperity, you know, and they are the ones who are suffering most from anxiety and depression. And unfortunately, it's often the ailments of the privileged, right? It's often that the more comfort-based and convenient your life is, the more you lose all the things that make you strong, resilient, or find meaning. And that's kind of what I was saying about parenting before, is that, yes, it's hard. And yes, it could be easier to just stay in my job or to, you know, be in Pilates every day, etc. And yeah, you know, marriage isn't a walk in the park. It takes work, and parenting takes a lot of work, etc. So there is convenience there too in avoiding that whole fiasco, that whole
project. Even divorce is a convenience that never used to exist, right? It used to be a real pain to try and break up that union. Now you can just, you know, do it and have a party.
You can, and many people do. I think some people would disagree with you that it's easy, or, you know,
I'm not saying easy like it's expensive. Right. I've been through it. It's not easy. It's not fun. It's not cheap. But comparatively to 200 years ago, it's easy.
Right. Well, it's allowed. It's
allowed and almost culturally celebrated.
Totally. Right? Like divorce parties. Yeah.
You're going to lean into, your friends are going to lean into fuck it, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Fuck them. Oh, yeah. Get out of there. Get out of there. Why is she talking to you like that? Get out of there. You know,
that's you've got to be very careful.
Into that now, unless you're highly religious, that's sort of the last thing kind of holding on to that, and the kids to a lesser extent.
Yeah, no, that's so true. I remember reading Eat, Love, Pray by Elizabeth Gilbert 20 years ago. Right? It was just at the beginning of my marriage. Did you read that one, Graham? You're nodding.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
And she was on Oprah's best-selling list, a New York Times bestseller, and she was celebrated. And then Julia Roberts played her in the movie. And the whole entire story is about, I left a perfectly good man who I loved because there was adventure out there, because there was some kind of solo adventure that I needed to embark on, and marriage is a trap, you know. And she was hailed as the author, as the celebrity of the time. And that's really what our culture is upholding as brave, stunning, you know, exciting.
What did you, what shifted you from your previous career to doing this work? Like, co-founder of HiFam and the books and all that. What?
Well, I come from a background in design. I always did identity strategy, marketing, graphic design, and I love it. And I still do a lot of that, you know, just in my day-to-day life. But when I became a parent, I did not want kids, by the way. I totally fell down that kind of, I don't know, maybe feminist or progressive idea that, and similar to you, Graham, like, oh, I can rise above this. I don't need this. Parents look so tired anyway. Like, it's okay. And my husband was like, that's like a red line. That's a no-go for me. Like, we can either get divorced or we're having kids.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was like, well, no, actually, I kind of do. Okay. but in my decision, and it's funny because I come from a big family, and a totally pro family culture. So that's just an indication of how strong these ideas are. You know, I went to art school, and everyone there was very kind of progressive and left leaning and, you know, eco aware and all of those things. And family was really seen as archaic, and marriage was really seen as patriarchal, and it was all very backwards. They were very unpleased with me that I was even married. But anyway, when I decided to have children, it wasn't from one of these like strong biological urges that I think a lot of women have. I was 24. It was more of an intellectual, logical decision of like, look, this is, you know, kind of a core human experience that I don't want to miss out on. So, and my husband is go hung on this, so let's make it happen. And so then I started becoming obsessed with learning everything I could about parenting. Like in that moment, I was like, okay, I've got to kind of crack this code. I want to think about it differently. I don't want to be as exhausted and disgruntled as all the parents around me seem to be. I ended up just as exhausted and disgruntled, but also I developed a new career in the direction of coaching it. I became very, very passionate about it. I have found that it's not the only path to meaning, but it's a very sound path. It's a good path for a lot of people. And I think, you know, I wouldn't want people out there to miss it by mistake, you know, or because of misinformation or that kind of thing. You know what I mean? At the very least that.
Was there a point when you had your first kid that you kind of went, wow, okay, I get it? Like, did actually having the kids like solidify all that for you?
It really did. Yeah. And, you know, it's one of those cliches that you can never, nothing can really prepare you for becoming a parent, and it's a type of love that you've never experienced. Yeah. And I think cliches sometimes become that way for a reason. It is hard to describe what overcomes you. One of the things that I think is powerful is that you, for the first time, are outside of your own self. You're not preoccupied only with your well-being, at least for me, and I think for most parents. There's this sense that someone else's life is now more important to you than your own. And that's actually, it's stressful, it's a lot of responsibility, but it's also very liberating, because especially in a selfie generation where it's all about your self-brand and it's all about you, and there's a lot of narcissism and a lot of self-love and self-acceptance and self-reflection and self-growth, and you know, you just work on you and you just love you and all of that stuff. Those were the messages that I was getting. There was suddenly someone else that took precedence. And yes, I need to take care of myself and be happy, but in the service of something larger than me. And many of us would like to leave an impact on the future. I think very few of us get to really do that. But if you're a parent, then in your small way, by definition, you are changing, or at least shaping the future to an extent, right? You're raising the next generation, and that's as much impact as anyone can hope to have in this world.
Yeah.
So in that regard, it really hit me, you know, in a powerful way.
Wow.
What about stuff like, you got this weird manosphere sort of popping up that seems to be, in fairness, a reaction to this like princessification of women, where they could do no wrong for like the early 2000s. They were sort of pedestalized, and now the men are sort of pushing back on that and saying, fuck you. But this seems to be a weird break there that seems to be hard to, I don't know how they put that back in the bottle.
So I want to say, like, I personally do not, I have a bit of an allergy to the battle of the sexes. I find it so immature and just wrong. I have four brothers and an amazing dad and an amazing husband and four sons. And I have nothing but love and admiration for masculinity.
Yeah, right.
You know, when done properly. Obviously, there are douches out there, but there are, you know, douchey women too. There are good people and bad people. And I think that's much more interesting to figure out the morality and, you know, of an individual rather than their sex. I think that's far less interesting. It's actually, I really do think we have a lot more in common than we have that separates us. I think what separates us makes it interesting. It's what's exciting. It's where the chemistry and the tension and the polarity is. And I think that both women and men would really do well to find admiration and trust and companionship and cooperation in their relationships with members of the opposite sex. And I just find, yes, that the feminist man, all men are trash, and even the Me Too movement that went way too far, and many of those things, they were toxic. That was toxic femininity. That was reputation destruction and character assassination. And by the way, like, you know, identity politics, like painting all men with the same brush just because they share the same chromosomes. I think it's insane. Not to mention hugely ignorant and ungrateful and entitled, because I know full well that I owe my life to many men, right? I know that most of us do. Men who protect us, men who build our power lines and, you know, all of the infrastructure of our societies, and they go thankless and, you know, unrecognized and then also demonized, you know, and I really can't stand it when people paint men, you know, as a gender with a bad brush, because I've been very lucky to know wonderful men, loyal, you know, moral, strong, you know, providers who are willing to defend their families, but also are, you know, noble and just admirable on every regard, innovative, you know, really fair, really deep thinkers. You know, there, I could go on and on with lists of men that I admire, you know?
How much do you think that has to do with your brothers and the relationship with your dad? How much of this is a symptom of breaking families just continuing getting worse? How much of it has to do with that compared to culture? Assuming those two are different. Because
I was going to say, are they different?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the culture is just sort of the movies and the stuff like that, and the Disney and the this and the feminism, all that sort of stuff on the culture side of things. And then.
Well, you know how they say that politics is downstream of culture? I think that culture is downstream of family. You know, I think what we see in Disney and in the movies and in culture at large, the Kardashians, whatever, is a reflection of how people are growing up, are being raised. And what you get at home, if you get at home the sense that family is meaningful and important, that we respect. You know, look, I have a daughter and sons, and when they're fighting or whatever, if they evoke gender in their fights, I correct them. I say, no, it's not because he's a boy. You don't like what he did. It's got nothing to do with him being a boy. And we don't talk about people because of their gender or the color of their skin or anything. I disagree about judging people based on their immutable characteristics. And I hold that across the board with my children. But okay, so hopefully my children are going to get that message from home. And that is what develops culture in the future, right? Now, am I biased because I grew up around great men? Sure, fine. But it's also an example that there are great men. And
the culture used to celebrate great men. So we all got to grow up with some of them. Even if you didn't,
yes,
they were like
exactly, celebrated exactly. And wonderful heroes. Yes. But I will also say it's not restricted to my family. I mean, my husband has a lot of guy friends, I don't know, 6 or 7 of them whose homes we belong in. My kids grow up in those homes. I'm like, good, go and see these men, learn from them. There's your model for masculinity, not just my family, right? A lot of people around me, many people around me. So I'm lucky in that. I know I'm lucky. It also isn't just luck. People are making this culture. People are working for it and protecting it. I know it's not just luck. And I think anyone can. It's harder, but anyone can. But I will say on the flip side, I think the same is true about women. You know, what the manosphere does, you know, painting all women with a broad stroke. Oh, women are gold diggers. All their kind of mind games about how to neg a woman. And I don't know, there's a limit to how much manosphere I can reproduce. But I've heard some of the ideas. By the way, some of them are okay. Some of them are based on evolutionary biology and just what is attractive to men and women on average. And I think that's fine. Like, it's good to teach men and women to be attractive to each other, to date well and that kind of thing. But when it becomes manipulation, when it becomes, oh, you know, I can't ever get married and have children because women are going to rob me blind and the legal system will mess me up. It's like, wait, you're cutting off your nose to spite your face. Don't you want, you know, a good partner and a life of a family? Don't you want a legacy? Wouldn't you prefer, you know, wouldn't it be better if the manosphere addressed its audience in helping them build those meaningful relationships and giving them hope and structure and steps to get there, rather than just saying opt out, you know, it's the matrix. So I think on both sides, you know, calling all men trash is ridiculous and awful, and everyone loses. And doing the same to women doesn't work. I just think the whole battle of the sexes is misplaced energy. And by the way, I think it's misplaced energy. Maybe if we go a level deeper and I get a little bit above my pay grade here, I don't know if I can fully support this, but I kind of think we went into moral relativism in the last few decades, where we're not allowed to say what we believe in, what's good and what's wrong, right? Evil and good as things that have become like taboo. We're not allowed to judge other cultures as inferior to our own or say what's better or worse. We're not allowed to say, you know, it's better to be married than to be divorced. That would be better. Like, we can't make those statements because it sounds judgmental or politically incorrect, or, you know, we're just very, very squirmish around saying those things. So we've turned on each other a little bit. Like, everybody needs an enemy. So now we've made the enemy within. Men and women are just fighting it out instead of building an incredible culture and saying, no, we're going to make an excellent culture that works, that is defendable, that is positive and is moral, sure, flawed, imperfect, but something worth fighting for. And I think people in the West often feel they don't have anything worth fighting for. You know, you ask in the UK, would you defend your country? And people say no, right? So they don't feel proud of their country. They don't feel proud of their flag, of their, you know, heritage, of their history, of their religion, of their nationality, of their family even. And so it becomes this petty fight, this infighting, I think, which is, you know, I don't know, it's such a waste of energy, like not a way to build a good life, I think.
That's really well said. Yeah, I agree. It feels engineered. My conspiracy brain, you know, sort of thinks that it's engineering, but part of maybe it's organic. Maybe it's modernity. Maybe this is what happens, you know.
Well, it's hard to think it's organic because, I mean, the number one threat to empire, power, monarchy, all of it throughout the ages has been family, right? The bigger your family is, the bigger those clans, the tighter those clans are. You slighted them, so we're into, you know, it is the biggest obstacle to empire is family, because family's not going to let certain things go.
Right, your tribe. And strong men. That's also weakening men and emasculating men and making them embarrassed just to be men is another way.
The women like them less and the women try to be men, which messes everything up to an even bigger extent, it seems like. I wouldn't mind unpacking that last one a little bit more, and just before we start wrapping up here, like, so if you could just sort of give one message to the women and to the men, what would sort of each of those be?
Well, it's the same message to both of them, really. I'll just say how I would say it to my children, as it were, which is that, you know, life is really hard. It's complicated and there are lots of ups and downs, and you get hit with things like a diagnosis or financial downturn or war or a hurricane. And it's really better to do it together. And men and women are built to work together, and it's solvable and figure outable. You can create the skills to communicate well, to build desire in your marriage and chemistry in a long lasting way, to find companionship and friendship and build trust. And it's up to you to become a formidable, attractive partner that someone wants to commit their loyalty to and to be devoted to for the rest of their life. And it's up to you to build that and defend that. And I think that's true for both men and women. I need to take, and, you know, so does my husband and so do my children, accountability for how we show up to our day. You know, if you mistreat someone, even if you're just unbearably moody, you know, or anxious all the time, those are things you've got to take care of. You've got to become a partner that is worth living with and worth living for. And someone who brings, you know, more relief and light than they do bring strain and distress and expectation. So that's one thing. And then another thing that I would say, this is my parenting philosophy, and it's not really mine, it's just research based on authoritative parenting, which is the best style of parenting, which is that our children and the men and the women in our societies need two things, and they always have to match. They really do need the high support that we want to give them. They need, you know, love and warmth and help and scaffolding and skills and to be taught things and to be shown things. They need high support, but they also need high expectations. They need someone to demand of them, to expect of them. I think a lot of men today and women, just no one's expecting anything of them. It's like, well, live your life, be happy and healthy. You do you, figure it out. And there's this expectation that they can somehow be a blank slate in the world, completely unlinked to previous generations, no expectations on their head. You know, going back to my mom saying, I'm having kids to replenish the Holocaust. You could say, I think to our modern ears, that sounds terrible. Like, wait, but what about your life? Why should you? You're not a baby machine. You're not the national womb. Like, you don't have to have kids just because something terrible happened to your parents. But there is something to having high expectations on you. Like, I have of my kids, I expect you to find a great partner, to build a marriage, to have children, to convey our values to them, to carry the torch forward, you know, and I do realize how archaic that sounds. But I do think people need that. I think the manosphere and modern feminism, fourth wave feminism, are very preoccupied, not with what is expected of me, but what my rights are, what my needs are. And modern people are very interested in what I need. You know, here's my list of what I'm looking for in a man, what I need in a man. If you don't do A, B, C, D, then I'm not even interested. That preoccupation with what you should get rather than what you expect to give, you know, it's backwards, you know, it's bass backwards. It's just not going to work or get you the results that you want. So let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. We don't need to become patriarchal or religious or unaccepting of the other or intolerant of differences. We can do all the good modern things and still maintain a culture that has ritual, that has connection, that has expectation, right? That has community.
And it'd be nice if it was more optional, right? If the women didn't have to work. Because that's sort of the feeling in the West, is like, it's not an option. It's not like, because I think that you could have it where it's like, if the woman wants to work, she can work, but that you don't need the money. It's not because you need the money. It's not because you need this job so you can make $3,000 a month so you can pay $2,200 of it to childcare, but that other $800 is the difference between making it or breaking it, which is sort of the scenario that most of the West seems to find itself in right now.
Well, it would be ideal, of course, if there was a surplus and if people could do it without feeling that they had to.
That really changes everything, right? That's the thing we go back to on the show here all the time. If we had a fucking surplus, if we had abundance, a lot of these things would take care of themselves. And when I look around, it seems like we should have abundance. Like we've already got the abundance. We're just not fucking using it properly.
Hmm. Can we touch maybe, I think one part that maybe we didn't get to is parenting advice or trying to the play aspect, like the children. Maybe we could just touch on your coaching for parenting and stuff too, as some of the theories you have on parenting, which probably is fairly important.
Yeah. So there's a lot of that, but you mentioned play and that's the topic of my book. So I'll just give that as one thing. Yeah. And I think in Canada, you'll feel this really well, is that just describe for me when you were kids, like what you were doing with your time.
I was going to mention that because we were out in the neighborhood with a bunch of different ages, right? We would play. Somebody said this and it really hit home with me. Like we'd go out at night until the dark or whatever. And we just, all the neighborhood would sort of play games or whatever, right? We'd make up stuff as we went along. We would just play out in the neighborhood with different genders, different ages. People would kind of rise to some sort of leadership roles or what, however, it was just all organic and natural, I think. So that's just one example.
Yeah. So I think, and I think, you know, babies of the 90s and the 80s and the 70s certainly share those experiences. And then as smart devices come in, as parents become more anxious about kidnapping for, you know, unnecessary reasons, but they did, as all sorts of, you know, surveillance kind of happens where we're watching each other all the time. And as women venture out into the workplace a lot more, you see just a very sharp decline in children playing. And the thing is that children are cubs. They're mammals, right? They're mammal cubs. And play is something that we see across all mammals. It's actually how mammals learn. It's this brilliant mechanism, you know, that Mother Nature gives to us where it's fun. So you don't even notice you're doing it. You want to do it. You're constantly drawn to play as a child. And it could be all sorts of play. It could be creative play. It could be mathematical play where you're figuring things out and building things and engineering. You know, a lot of social play, role reversal, taking turns, leadership positions, like you said, figuring out a lot of conflicts, dealing with, you know, this one has that handicap and this one is, you know, much faster than everyone else. And how do we equalize the playing field and figuring out those situations? And the thing is that play is that mechanism from Mother Nature for how we learn. And the goal of childhood and the reason we have such an elongated childhood is because humans are really intelligent species and we have a lot to learn. And the longer the childhood, the more intelligent the species, because there's years and years and years of gradual development. And it's a really terrible experiment to run on a society to stop kids from playing, to take away play, free play. And even better if it's kind of unsupervised play.
Yes.
What do you think is more important though, the free or the play? Because a lot of it to me, when you talk about that, just sounds like autonomy.
Yeah, independence.
Maybe they don't want to play. Maybe they want to go hunting. Maybe they want to go fishing. Maybe they want to X, Y, Z. But it seems like free and play are sort of both holding up 50% of that union.
Yeah, they go hand in hand because when you give a child freedom, they play, right? They figure out what to play. It could be at hunting or fishing, and it could be at building a house, and it could be at, you know, playing mommy and daddy. The thing is that they'll be practicing the skills that are needed in their adult society, right? We see little mountain goats play at, you know, pushing themselves to the edge of their comfort and balance on a rock, right? To gain those skills that are necessary for escaping, you know, being prey as adults. Like they're constantly pushing their skills. The monkeys, they're just, you know, they're learning to jump from rope to rope, etc. Every single animal is playing at their adult skills. So you'll see lion cubs rolling around with each other, hunting and you know, on each other. And children do that too. They'll play house, they'll play job, right? They get their briefcase, they're ready to go off for their job. They play all these things that they see their adults doing. And And that looks just like it's cute, but it's actually building exactly what they need to build. And they'll even place things like literacy and numeracy and all the laying all the foundations in the neuronal pathways in their brain to then be able to actually absorb and mature. And so the freedom part is really crucial as well. Okay. It's because children have to take risks. Children have to go at high speeds, jump from high heights, play with dangerous tools like knives. You probably did that when you were kids. You probably played with fire at some point or another, being alone, dealing with strangers. There were all sorts of situations that were risky. And that's the reason parents stopped them from doing it in the 90s. They were like, oh, now we're risk averse. Now children shouldn't be allowed to do any of that stuff. And I'll just plug Israel again. This sounds like an advert for Israel. It really isn't. It's just interesting to know that when I moved to America, I suddenly felt so self-conscious about letting my kids walk to the library by themselves or that kind of thing, because my friends got picked up by the police for that kind of thing, for reals. Like, that was a real thing that happened. And in Israel, it's very common to see young children, you know, six, seven, as the kids like to say today. That's my kids' favorite thing. Walking along the street by themselves, going to the playground, going down to the store, you know, that kind of thing. So the freedom.
But it's really happening. I mean, you mentioned it, you kind of touched on it earlier, but there's never really been a safer time to be a kid in the West. I mean, provided you don't have your phone on. Basically, if you're not on your phone and you're a kid, no matter what you're doing in North America and I mean, Western Europe, maybe not as much as it used to be, but in North America, at least, the kids are safer than ever. Kidnapping, all of it is way down. It's way, way, way down if you look at the stats. The kids are in the safest environment they've ever been in, other than the stuff we're doing.
Right. Well, that's exactly right. I think they need a lot more freedom in the real world and a lot less freedom online. And what's going on online, look, it does reduce risk to have your kid just scrolling on their phone all day in their bedroom. Of course, teenage pregnancy is down, car accidents are down. I get it. They're not getting into trouble. Cool. But they're also not learning any of the skills that they need to be successful adults. So they remain in childhood. And I think it's part of why
we're already seeing, right? Like I'm 45, I think, 45 now. And I've got like a bunch of buddies that play video games probably 30 hours a week.
Yeah.
Have wives, have kids, video games 20 to 30 hours a week. That's what they're looking forward to when they get home from work, which is probably already a consequence of exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, we see that in a lot of things, like this kid kind of like elongated.
Did any of us picture a grandpa playing a video game after work? Coming home to play Call of Duty for 4 hours straight?
Well, it is quite a powerful example, yeah. I mean, I don't want to poo-poo the gamer community. I know that it's a viable
I've pissed off the gamers. I call them out.
Yeah. Well, I guess to me, I think it's good
to about it like that gamer itself is like, to me, it looks like a symptom of not growing up properly. There was a time when that was like just a natural progression that you stopped playing video games, unless you were playing them with kids.
Yeah, but there was always games. There was always chess and dice, and people have always been playing games.
That's different than video games, I would argue. And it wasn't like you went home and played chess for 6 hours straight until it was bedtime. And if you did, you were probably picking up more skills. I don't know. But I really feel like the video games especially is this sort of this thing that pursues all the way through adulthood that the other games don't, right? Like Graham and I aren't going out to play hide and seek. We play little games. Adults are still playing games. They're still gamifying things. But the games kind of evolve with maybe responsibility and those sorts of things. Whereas that seems to be, I mean, this kind of goes back to the men and women thing. Men are in a state of arrested development in the West, and that we need to sort of admit that there's a reason that, I mean, the feminism thing, all that is causing problems too, but a lot of men are overgrown children in the West right now. And I think that's part of the problem.
Yeah, I would say that's true for women as well. In a big way.
It just looks different for me to women. It's harder for me to judge that side of things because I'm not a woman.
Yeah,
but I just
know, but you know, I'll give you an example.
I can't play a video game because it's like, I should be doing something to make things better for either myself or my family. Or if I'm not doing those and I am playing games, it should be with my fucking family or out in the bush hunting so I can feed my family or with my kids and my family, getting that family time and not like online with people I'll never meet running through scenarios that are just retarded, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, I think sometimes the video games simulate that level of rush and the masculine side of defending, right? A lot of them are war games. If you're playing Call of Duty, listen, I don't know. I mean, I have a lot of family who's been in combat for many years and they'll still enjoy a game of Call of Duty. I mean, it's fun to unwind and leisure, I think, is important for everyone. But I think what you're pointing to is the balance. Like, you want to feel leisure after you've sweat, right? After you've worked hard, after you've invested into the people who matter to you, after you've brought value to a situation. And if you're spending that many hours at it, I think it can sometimes feel like it's coming at the expense of being of service, right? It's like, well, I sometimes feel when I watch Netflix, like, why do I have time to watch Netflix? I'm a grown up. Like, I shouldn't be allowed to just binge a show. I should be doing something that's expanding me intellectually or spiritually or of service to my family. I should go and batch cook, you know, or something like that. Like that. But of course there's a place for leisure, but I think that's, you know, kids are just always in a mindset of leisure. Like they're, you know, they don't have a job, they don't have responsibilities. And that's what makes it seem so immature when you can do it for just so many hours, right? When you're just, but I do think that sometimes the content of those games is scratching an itch for those men of feeling like, you know, it's a simulation literally of brotherhood, of risk, of danger,
masculinity, strategy,
tactics, all of that stuff. So that's very real. And with the women, the arrested development sometimes comes through in, you know, this is, women are going to hate me in the comments for this one, but I can say about myself, I think that being overly emotional, being on emotional roller coasters and being like drama, falling into drama is immature. And I think that that's appropriate for a 14-year-old girl and it's not appropriate for a 30-year-old woman. And that's something that we do now as a woman. Like, you think my grandma was having hissy fits and tantrums and being overly sensitive and, you know, talking about her emotions ad nauseum to my grandpa? No. No one had patience for that. No one had time for that. There were more important things to do. They had perspective about life. And she knew she was a grown-up. And it was inappropriate to be self-absorbed in that way. You know, so that's an example of one of the ways that I think us women often fall into like a very immature cycle in a world of plenty and comfort and convenience and prosperity, right? We have all that peace and all that time. You start scratching yourself. You start navel-gazing, you know?
And the world was better for it. I mean, those were that's when we built stuff, did cool stuff, had like felt responsibility to the next generation and all that sort of stuff. Where now it's like, fuck them. Fuck the boomers. Fuck the zoomers. I'm going to get mine and get out. Avidal, this has been great. Is there anything we didn't touch on that we need to mention before we start to wrap up?
Not from my perspective. This was a fantastic conversation. It was so interesting to talk to you guys.
Yeah, it's good. Keep up the good work, yeah.
Where can people follow your work and get the book and that sort of stuff? We'll put all the links in the show notes, of course, but for the people that never bother to check those, we like to just mention the URLs.
Thank you.
Here.
Well, my kind of company is called HiFam, so that's hi like hello, HIFAM. So they can just go to HiFam.com. They can find me on YouTube at HiFam and on my podcast at HiFam Life. And I would love to coach and help. And you're very much warmly invited into my programs if you want to build a strong family culture.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, my mom's in the chats just in time. Hey, Mom. Avidal, this has been great. We appreciate you coming on the show. Keep up the good work and come back anytime.
Thank you so much, guys. Be well. Yeah.
Take care.
Ciao. And that was our chat with Avital Levy, building resilient families. What'd you think?
That was great. Yeah, that was,
that really was great. I don't know where that one came from. I'm going to have to.
Sometimes we have listeners suggesting people too, and then we go after it. And it's
and
hard
then
to
nowadays, like the booking scene has gotten so, like, I can't even tell when a booker's an AI or when it's a real person or what is going on. So it came across like it was someone who was listening to the show spreading it, but nowadays you never know if that's just the promotional side of it.
Right.
You never know.
Fake listeners suggesting Real guests.
Good guests, though, so we won't complain. Keep up the good works. Big thanks to Avital for coming to the show. Big thanks to you guys for listening. Even bigger thanks if you're one of the 1% or 2% that choose to support the work. GrandAmerica.ca/support. Keep the show going. We're 13 years coming up here in another month. And I guess, no, 2 months. 2 months? April and May. June 1st. 13 years. Thanks to you guys. We wouldn't be doing it anymore. We got no ads, no sponsors, none of that stuff. Just you guys, GrandAmerica.ca/support. Sign up for a monthly or make a one-time donation. And then the show will still be here next week. And if you don't, it might not be. So check that out. Check out GrandAmericaOutlaw.ca for the podcast. Contact at thecabin.com for trips and events. There is a couple weeks left to get in on the Easter Island trip. But the solstice one coming up in June. If you want to come to Serpent Mound, Randall Carlson in the fall. Check out GrandAmericaCBD.com for gummies and tinctures and disastermaps.ca for our new software venture. Other than that, we love you guys. Thanks for listening. And we will see you next week.
5 pink flamingos and a few flamenco dancers. They're in the kitchen and they're baking Day of the Dead cookies. And I step into the kitchen and I'm like, let me have a looky, see what kind of cookie you're cooking up. And they're looking up at me skeptical, and I point next to my spectacles. And I'm wearing a maroon Harvard t-shirt. Yeah, I know I'm a smart cookie, but I'm no psychic. You can come and ring my bell, but where we're gonna end up in the future, I can never tell. I can never tell. Me and 5 of my best friends and a few of my enemies, we're at the coffee shop, settling our differences. Benjamin Otto pulls out a game of Chinese checkers and he orders a cappuccino. And I pick blue and he picks red and you pick yellow. And I'm wearing a tie-dye peace sign t-shirt. Yeah, I know I'm a peacenik, but I ain't no hypocrite. You can come and ring my bell, but where we're gonna end up in the future, I can never tell. I can never tell. One bell, one man. And with my sense of smell, I can smell the salt in your tears. I can sense your fears. You're hoping for a bit of divinity in this worldly vicinity. And you understand the fragility of the human vessel. And you sit Indian style like a pretzel. And you levitate to a transcendental state when you meditate. And you levitate to a transcendental state when you meditate. And you levitate to a transcendental state.